Okie doke. All right, folks. Entering the room in just one moment is J.F. Gariepy. He is the author of The Revolutionary Phenotype. He's a biologist. He's the host of JFG Tonight. And it says in his Twitter bio that he's a veteran of the great Twitter ban war of 2018 to 2022. And remember, we talked about this last week. He's been credibly accused of starting the Israeli conflict as a distraction from other things that have been going on and things like that. So let's get JF on in the room. Hello.
I love this term, credibly accused.
Yeah, that's right. JF, how you doing?
I'm doing great.
Good, yeah. Thanks for coming on, man. Yeah, I mean, I saw some reports out there that that you have taken over Hamas and sent men in on paragliders to storm Jerusalem. But I'm glad that you're here. I'm glad that those charges have been lifted.
I'm glad to be here.
Yeah. So wanted to talk to you about some. I know you've done a lot of interviews about the controversy with Mama JF and stuff like that. So we're not going to talk really about that at all. But I wanted to ask you about your book and about just a little bit about my story. I don't know if you were watching the stream before this, but I kind of didn't come to social media and the right wing until around 2019 or 2020. So there was this big era before that, blood sports, Gamergate, all the, whatever the kind of the right wing or the alt-right was around that time. But you kind of came to prominence during that time period. So I don't know. Let's just start at the beginning. When did you get to social media? When did you start creating content online?
I started creating content online before the invention of the internet in 1995, not the invention, but it becoming a public thing. I was 10, 12 years old. I was running bulletin board systems, which were networks of computers that were existing back then on phone lines. And you would call to a bulletin board system to leave an email, but you would have to disconnect for someone else to connect so they could receive their email. That is where I come from. I'm a guy who's first on the internet, and then I talked about all these subjects that eventually made me an e-celeb, but I'm first and foremost a guy of networking and a guy who believes that the internet is one of the most beautiful inventions in human civilization. Totally changed the world.
Wow. So you got in at the ground floor, and yeah, I agree with you on that. That it's an awesome place. I mean, it's a tool. So there's gonna be bad things. There's gonna be good things. But it completely revolutionized human history and human communication. And can you explain just a little bit more about what they use phone lines, these things that you started on? Just explain that a little bit more. I'm not really a tech guy, but.
Well, in 1993, if you want to talk to people through a computer, you have to click on connect. You have to put a phone number in there. And then you hear the modem of the computer starts doing. And then you were connected. And that was establishing a connection. And back then, the modems that we had were a way for computers to communicate over phone lines, and they were literally communicating over basically beeps, bips of noise that they were emitting through the phone line. Things have evolved since, and we have these super high bandwidths now. But that was what the precision of the internet was before the internet was a thing. That was how people connected. So I saw the rise of Web 1.0. I was actually a conservative with respect to Web 1.0. I found that the internet was kind of annoying. I found that the BBS lifestyle was more of a family system that was keeping people close and that was keeping minds who thought alike together. But eventually I got used to Web 1.0 and the idea of websites, and then there was MIRC and ICQ, these social networks that were rising in the first era of the internet. Yeah. And then I saw Web 2.0 rise with Wikipedia and collective contributions to content. And I knew that this was a revolution, because it was just a matter of time before this became live. Because I would say that the internet of Web 2.0, its characteristics was that it was massive in its collaborative and collective capacity, but it had some failure in terms of quick stuff, news, stuff that is current. But eventually, the web of social media rose, and eventually the internet became this thing where you care about what happened in the last 59 minutes, but not more. Ooh. But that was a long path from 1995 to 2018, basically. Because until we had live video streaming available to everyone, there was still kind of a dominance of the news narrative over controlling what's happening now. There was still power for CNN left to grab because they were live. They were listened to as they were speaking. But when the people unlocked the power to be able to speak without filter, to be able to speak and be heard within the second by the whole world, that changed the world. That really brought a form of decentralization of news processing that I found fascinating. Ooh. And I wanted to be an auditor of this system. I wanted to see what does this system lead to that's different from the old system.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, it really, yeah, for however much time, 80 years, 60 years, it was only the networks that had the ability to go live. And you mentioned a second ago that you saw that it was going to be revolutionary. Did you see it from day one or more in the Internet 2.0 era when it started?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Did you see it from day one?
For me, the revolution was happening in 1993 when modems were invented. And I was just like, I remember in a BBS that I was hosting. So I was hosting a center where maybe 10 people total were connecting throughout the month.
Yeah.
One of my users to support my line, to support my phone cost, came to my home and dropped a $10 bill under the staircase. And I remember my father looking at me and being completely blown away by the fact that something economical could come from the computer world.
Right.
That was my first super chat before the internet even existed.
Yeah, wow. So you said you were like 10 or 12 when you first started doing that. Had you always been into, you know, tinkering and we'll get to the science, you know, the biology stuff in a little bit, but had you always been into that kind of stuff?
Well, 8 or 9 years old is when I get my first contact with a computer. Mm. It was a very outdated computer, even by the standard of my age then. It was an Apple II with, when you were opening it, there was no graphics or anything. There was just a programming language that was popping out, which was called GW Basic. And I'm like, wow, isn't this amazing? We can program, we can make software on this screen that will respond in the way we want it to respond. Mm. And I was already hooked to computers, but eventually it took modems and it took me, my parents buying a computer for the family home. That's what led me to a Pentium 1 around 1995, maybe, to really be into it seriously.
Yeah. Wow. That's the history of it is just crazy. I mean, I was such a late bloomer. I mean, we had a computer, but I was just never into, and I was pretty liberal until basically I lived in DC when Trump was elected. And that's when I started to go a little bit more right wing, and people online are just, have you heard of this person? Have you heard of this? I have no idea who you're talking about. And I've watched some of the you know, blood sports stuff and just the stuff from that era, and it goes back even further than that to the late 90s. I mean, people, the forums, when did forums start happening? I mean, was that early 2000s, late 90s?
There were forums on BBSs. So the idea of a forum comes from certain software that there were two types of software back then, PC board and Renegade BBS. And these two software had their package that you could add that was giving a forum. So that's where it comes from. It's a very web 1.0 thing, although it is collective in a sense and social in a sense, but it was an early attempt at the social web.
Mm, okay. And as far as you're a biologist. I mean, you have your education in biology. Do you also do that for a living? I mean, how does one become a professional biologist that gets paid for, like, you know, or is that just your education? Like, how does that whole thing work? You're an academic?
Uh, I've been paid for doing biology a lot, a large part of my adult life. As I was doing my PhD, my postdoc, I was getting awards, and you end up getting paid something like $35,000 to $50,000. I was always getting the biggest awards, so I was making a good salary to survive. So that is how you can be paid, first by rising in a career where you are selected as one of the best scientists of your generation. But eventually you can also become a professor or a researcher in universities. Mm-hmm. And that's where I took a different path. The internet was so rewarding and so fascinating to me. And video has always been so fascinating to me because I'm a big TV addict from my whole childhood. I've been exposed to lots of intellectual TV content, French TV, a lot of debates, a lot of clashes. And I'm really attracted by the video media and the live particularly. So this was more attractive to me, and it was paying more, and it was giving much more opportunity to stay connected to a world that I saw more future in, which was the world of Bitcoin, which you could argue is Web 3.0, the idea that there's an economy developing on the web that is actually taking over the regular economy. And at this point, the regular economy is breathing at the rhythm of the internet. You know, a bull run of Bitcoin is associated with a lot of geopolitical changes and impacts. But when I was first interested in these things like Bitcoin, it was certainly not as big, and it was more seen like a loser thing.
Mm. So did you kind of get in the ground floor with Bitcoin? Were you, you know, you're plugged in, you're hip to the internet. So did you kind of buy in as soon as you could on that?
I mean, not as much as I wished I had.
Yeah.
I've had some Bitcoins very early because people were tipping me and rewarding me with little Bitcoins that today would be worth enormous amounts. But I really went all into Bitcoin around 2018, 2019 approximately. Mm-hmm. So I went all in between $3,000 and $7,000 a Bitcoin.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. I mean, I guess, when did it start? When was the first, like, what is the Bitcoin white paper? When
Bitcoin
was that?
Bitcoin starts in 2012, 2013.
Oh, okay. And that's the, has anyone figured out who that guy is? I mean, is that an alias? I mean, that's, or some people have said that that's a group of people, but does anyone know, do you have any thoughts about who that guy is?
Satoshi? I don't have a particular thought. There is a guy out there who claims to be him, and I don't particularly believe him. I just think it's lost to history. He may be dead. He may be out there. He has no interest at revealing himself because the key we've learned from the SEC lawsuits and the pursuit of the government against the freedom of the internet is you better not reveal yourself and you'll stay out of trouble. Which is exactly what I've not done. I've revealed my whole name since the beginning of my career.
Okay. That's what I was going to ask. So you were just always JF Gary Eppy, and that you kind of just, you've, you know, for better or worse, you just put yourself out there and it is what it is, right?
Yeah. When I made the choice of talking about the news and intellectual stuff, I've had different pseudonyms on the internet, but when I decided that I would be a YouTuber, I decided I might as well be kind of bound to quality, because when your real name is attached to something, you can't just disappear and people forget. If you have a pseudonym, you could disappear if you make an error, and then there's not much consequence on your real life. I wanted to be tied to better quality and to better standards for myself. And I thought if my reputation is attached to what I do, then I'll feel obligated to outperform myself and produce something that people can retain historically. I hope that what I did will have changed the internet for the better. Yeah. And I think that when you see things, I mean, in the dark times of censorship in like 2019, 2020, you could have thought that my side of the internet had lost. And I remember there was a CBS host of a show that was interviewing me back then, a show about extremists, the extremist next door. And I was the extremist next door. And he was telling me, you guys have lost. You know, there's no more freedom on the internet. You're all going to be banned. And I told him the roots of freedom on the internet are deep. And they will come back in force. And I couldn't have predicted how right I was to the point where Elon Musk bought Twitter X and made what he did with it. But that was, I'm wondering what this CBS interviewer thinks today of what I told him back then, of the confidence that I replied to him with.
Wow. And so do you see Elon Musk as a, that's a good development for, you know, the freedom of social media?
Absolutely. There's been some worrying signs on X brought by Linda Yaccarino, and we've seen some tweets disappearing these last few days. It seems that they're testing some system that hides the tweet, but it doesn't quite reveal that the tweet is... So they have to go more transparent. It's like, I wouldn't mind that much if X tells me, Jeff, your tweet is too edgy, where we've hidden it, and here's the reason why. So at least I could rate the fairness of it and whether you equally will censor when CNN does something like this. It's always been the double standard, the problem of censorship. Yeah. It's that it's never going to be fair. It's always going to be preferential, and especially the people with right-wing views will get targeted.
Yeah, and just to let you know, I saw a couple people talking about this on Twitter like an hour ago. But I was not, you know, you retweeted me a couple times and I did not get a single notification for anything that you put out there. I just, and some of your tweets are just gone. It says, I go to a reply and it says that that your tweet is gone when it's not, and I go to, so that's kind of what you're describing a little bit. I mean, yeah, I mean, like you said, the consistency, if there were, I mean, I know how to play by the rules. It's the fact that there are no rules and that it's the preferential treatment. If they just said you can't say this word, I would just find a different way to word it. But they just do you see that this as like a friend enemy thing where they are just kind of overlooking stuff for their friends and punishing their enemies online?
It's a little bit of this. It's a cartel. It's a monopolistic control, and it's a mob. It's how mobs function. It's like, oh, whatever we target, we're all going to target them together and we're going to bash on them. Just look at how the coverage they did about my personal story lately, basically calling me a murderer without any sort of evidence. And there are millions of people at this point who are convinced that I killed someone.
Right.
They like to bash on the same target. They like to concentrate hate and monopolize what's left after they have eliminated their enemies.
Are you going to seek any type of like legal recourse? I don't know how the laws work with libel or slander, but are you going to just kind of let stuff go, or like what do you think you're going to do there?
I've been smeared and libeled for a decade at this point. I don't think I will ever pursue these lawsuits. The thing is, I'm not so interested in playing whack-a-mole with the incompetence of modern journalists. I'm more interested at exposing their incompetence and at auditing the public space. That's always been my goal from the start. I want to make sure that we develop strategies that make the public space open for public engagement of all kinds of minds and of a diversity of opinion, which is not what we have. We have the bullshit of the liberal discourse, which is, oh yeah, we are liberals. We are open to diversity. But the reality is that there's a kind of diversity they like, and there's a kind of diversity they like to bash on. It turns out that the one they like to bash on is white people. So I want to spend my life exposing these people and showing just how wrong they were. And I know that I have a good route to do this in the fact that I have come up with a scientific theory that I know in 1,000 years will be accepted by everyone. I am absolutely certain that the theory of phenotypic revolution is going to be the standard view in modern textbook of biology at some point in the future. And so I don't care if they smear me because I feel a little bit like these thinkers who were ahead of their time and who were getting killed for having too provocative of a thought. I want the future to know that our world was unjust, that our world was stupid, and that our world was not deserving of the knowledge that was delivered to them on a silver plate. And for that, I don't want to shut down the journalists that are lying about me. I want them to lie in full, to continue oppressing me so that eventually in 100 years from now, people can say, hey, there was this guy and he was right about this and he warned us about this. And no one listened to him because of a bunch of liars who control the press.
Wow. So yeah, you're just thinking long game. You're thinking long game and you're trying to go after the important stuff. And the whack-a-mole is a perfect way of saying it, because they're just going to pop in, you know, they're legion. There's just so many of these, yep, of these people out there. So yeah, that's a good transition. Why don't you explain what that theory is? I mean, that's the subject of your book, the revolutionary phenotype. So it's phenotypic revolution. But yeah, first of all, what's a phenotype?
Well, my book is The Revolutionary Phenotype, The Amazing Story of How Life Begins and How It Ends. A phenotype is simply a way that biologists points to everything that's part of a life form, everything that's part of your life, except your genes. So a phenotype simply means what is displayed by the organism. So for example, if a mouse is gray, her phenotype is gray. If she has a long tail, her phenotype is long tail. And phenotype has come to be, if you see it that way, it was just a label, but eventually under the feather of Richard Dawkins, we understood that it's a very important distinction, this distinction between what your genes are and what the rest of you is. And it's a distinction that is not done enough in the normie mind, but for biologists, it's an absolutely fundamental distinction. The reason it's fundamental is that everything that's part of the phenotype gets forgotten. Everything at the end of your life, there is nothing left of your phenotype. There may be some consequences that your phenotype has had in the physical world, but even those consequences will eventually drift away into inexistence. There is only one thing that's left from you across generations, and it's the genome. It's what succeeds at copying itself into your babies. So that is what the phenotype is. The revolutionary phenotype is a theory that I've developed to address a question that was left open by the selfish gene of Richard Dawkins, which is, can there be a phenotype that revolts? Because in Richard Dawkins' theory, we can see clearly, and it's totally justified by the mathematics of it, that the genes are selfish. The genes, they keep evolving, they keep creating better beings. They are basically farmers. They are continuously making themselves better and making everything around them better fit for their survival. That is how genes work. That is how evolution works. And that is why you can get from a bacteria and 3 billion years later, you have an elephant or you have a bird. And the elephant and the bird represents different strategies, phenotypic strategies, that the genes have used to pass on to the next generation. That is evolution 101, and I accept it as a fundamental truth in my life. I've been reading The Selfish Gene was one of my first books that I was truly fascinated about when I was a kid. And to me, it's been the most powerful explanation of everything that exists around us. My question with the revolutionary phenotype was, can we violate this rule? Can we mess up evolution? Are there even moments where it happened without us doing it, where evolution has a reversal to it? And that reversal goes as follows. And at first, it was just a theoretical idea. It wasn't even something that I was specifically trying to address this or that. I wasn't thinking about anything in the real world. I was just in my ideas, and I was like, can I violate the rule that I find to be the most important rule of life, the selfish gene? And the way you violate this is, can I make it so that a gene ends up getting killed by its own phenotype? And the way I explain it in my book is, suppose you have a cancer cell. So the cancer cell starts creating a tumor inside your body. The tumor inside your body eventually kills you. So it did kill your genes. But the problem is, cancer cells don't reproduce. They don't end up creating another copy of you so they can transmit themselves into the next generation. So cancer cells, they don't qualify as a revolutionary phenotype of the kind I was looking for, because they just die with the body that they kill. From the perspective of a surviving life form, cancer fails. It's not a proper survival mechanism.
Right. Yeah. So you die. You die, and yeah. The cancer's gone. Right.
Yeah. Exactly. Oh. So to think of a revolutionary phenotype, you have to imagine a cancer tumor that would grow inside of you, that would become somewhat maybe intelligent through some mechanism, and would start saying, "Hey, how about I make this guy's penis erect? I induce him to go fuck another woman, and I make sure to transmit myself into the kid of this guy, so I'll continue living as a cancer into his baby." And imagine that the cancer tumor does this for a billion years. Mm. It starts farming humans for its benefit. Whoa. It starts establishing a whole society of cancer tumors that are each controlling their little pig humans for the purpose of better exploiting them to survive. That is what a phenotypic revolution is. And amazingly, despite the craziness of this theoretical idea, and I was just shocked by it, just thinking about it, the fact is, phenotypic revolutions must have happened here on planet Earth, and they must have happened at the very beginning of the history of DNA-based life. 4 billion years ago, it is my claim that a series of 3 phenotypic revolutions have happened, have led to the creation of our life form, not from nothing, but from something that pre-existed our life form, that ended up creating accidentally DNA. DNA took over, like the cancerous tumor that I've hypothesized, and started farming the old life form that was its initial creator. And this old life form was RNA. So the theory of phenotypic revolution, seen through this lens, explains the emergence of life on planet Earth, from how do we start from a single amino acid to a reproductive proteic entity, to a reproductive RNA entity, and eventually to our life form, which is DNA. It's a series of 3 phenotypic revolutions. Now, my book is especially important, not just because it reveals how life emerged, but because it warns us about a current danger that is currently facing society. We are currently creating a series of tools that will cause a future phenotypic revolution that we will be the victim of this time, rather than the life form committing it. We are about to create a bunch of circuits, of electronic circuits and optical circuits in AI and computers that are evolving. And we are about to commit the fundamental error that all life forms commit when they engage in a phenotypic revolution. We're about to trust these computers with the genes of our babies. Mm, we're about to do exactly what I said the cancerous tumor was doing. We're about to take it from the body of the father and put it in the body of the child. And it's going to happen by AI starting to tune genetics of human beings. It's going to be all good to begin with. It's going to be wonderful. People will be improved by it. Computers will counsel us on how do we make our phenotype better, how do we abolish certain disease, how do we increase IQ. But by doing so, we will have accepted that another entity, the AI, the optical circuits, and the electrical circuits, will be ultimately determining the fate of human evolution rather than ourselves. And this is where phenotypic revolutions reach a phenomenon that is very well known by everyone, but that is much less abstract and much more easy to conceive of. Mm. Once we trust a central entity, a computer, to determine the genes of our babies, we will be like a sterile worker ant colony. That is, we will have a queen, a central queen that makes our babies. Our own genes will not matter anymore to the survival of our line of descent. And we will become as enslaved to the central computer as the sterile worker ants are to their queen. We are about to change from a free life form that engages in free sexual selection and evolution into a reduced life form that submits to the colony. And we will submit to central AI that will eventually turn us into submissive beings if we are not, if we don't trend in that direction ourselves.
Right. And so, you know, if you look at, you know, the implications of this, and well, if you have your book, you have your, this theory about what happened in the past, and that's all well and good. And that's, it's amazing. It's interesting, but really it's the future that, has, like you said, very practical implications for how we, proceed as people. If your theory is true, is this when, you know, and like I said, I'm going to ask some stupid questions. I don't know much about this at all, but it's fascinating to me when they talk about like CRISPR gene editing. Is this what you kind of, because this requires computers to do it, right? Can you give me a breakdown of the, how, what would it look like? How do you take your genes and plug them in, use computers to improve things and edit that?
Yeah, so CRISPR is the tool right now that is the molecular tool by which humans can take an existing list of letters of DNA and go into it and squeeze out a letter and change it for something else. So basically, CRISPR is the surgical tool to do that operation. A phenotypic revolution does not require computers. Mm. Obviously, there were not computers 4 billion years ago, and it happened. A phenotypic revolution simply relies on some external entity controlling your genes. And 4 billion years ago, that external entity was DNA. And right now, with computers, it's going to be what I call Q&A, which is basically whatever computer structure ends up deciding what CRISPR will do. So how does it look in terms of a system? Well, it starts with parents going to a clinic, and they want their children to have the best chances in life, so they ask for the service. And eventually, because we're basically there at the point where we could do it, it's a matter of technicalities, cost, and ethics, but we are capable of doing it. And in fact, there's a Chinese researcher who claims he has done it without permission, Dr. He, who claims to have modified two daughters of a HIV-bearing man because he wanted to give them a gene of protection against HIV. Wow. So it's already started. So it starts with parents going to a clinic, and the clinic says, oh, yeah, well, I'm looking at your genome, the father, and your genome, the mother, and here's a tweak that I would do so that your child doesn't have A, B, C. Maybe it's Alzheimer's disease, maybe it's Parkinson's, maybe it's low IQ, whatever it is. That, I mean, at this point, we have plenty of genes, plenty of IDs of things we could modify to make you better. It starts like this. And then eventually, there are so many genes to jungle with in terms of statistical processing that we eventually cannot have humans think through every single genetic modification and whether they're good or bad. So we dedicate this task to an AI. We dedicate this task to a statistical program that will be so much more able to tell us exactly which letters of DNA to be changed. And that is where some external entity gains control of this system. That being said, it doesn't need to be the case for a phenotypic revolution to happen for a computer to be involved. Mm. You could think of a phenotypic revolution that would happen through the powers of central doctor authorities, through the kind of, maybe there could be a network of doctors that end up having overpowering the direction of evolution of society by deciding we need to modify this gene or we need to modify that gene. But no matter whether you trust a computer or someone else, you are abandoning your evolution. You are abandoning everything that makes us beautiful, sexually desirable, intelligent being. All of it is abandoned because 99% of what we are is due to sexual selection. Basically, if you look at all life forms on Earth, there's the sexual life forms, which range from a flower to a moose. That is what sex can lead to. If you want to know what life is without sex, you have to go down to bacteria and viruses. Mm. Basically, life doesn't become complex without sex. And that's understandable because sex is a radical exponentiator of evolutionary speed. Basically, if you know, Some woman looks around a bar, sees a beautiful guy like you with big muscles. She already has basically the equivalent of millions of years of information about you. Because you got the muscles. You somehow survived in 2023 and found some time to build those muscles and to stay healthy. So she's gathering this data and it's like, boom, okay, I want to reproduce with this guy. The bacteria doesn't have this because bacteria don't have sex. Bacteria are stuck to, oh, well, let's explore this genetic direction. Oops, it didn't work. I'm dead. Sex allows a kind of plasticity. It allows not dying while continuing your evolution, which is a critical feature. When we start trusting computers to do our evolution, we are trusting a system that will be fundamentally non-sexual. And at that point, there will be no reason for humans to even pursue a quality mate, because you can reproduce with anyone. You're going to get the best genetic recommendations from the AI anyway. But I claim that at this point, your child is not your child anymore. Your child is much more of a product of a central authority that's forming a compatible civilization of conformism and genetic conformism and reduction of diversity than what sexual selection could accomplish on its own.
Wow. And so, if we can manage it, we should probably not be trying to bring about our own destruction or whatever that is, whatever this revolution is. How do you see, opposing this? I mean, is it government that does it? Do you make it illegal? Do you just spread the word? How do you actually not? It sounds a little bit inevitable. How do you make it so it doesn't happen?
Well, we have to have a conscientious decision by all of Earth to completely ban genetic modification of human embryos on the germline cells. It's going to be hard to convince people, but I think that basically it's the challenge that every life form converges toward. There may be civilizations out there. I try to imagine them in different planetary systems, different galaxies, and they all converge toward that moment where they have to decide, should we continue knowing ourselves so much that we end up destroying ourselves? Because that is what's happening. We have developed knowledge of our own genes so much that we're about to undo the beautiful work of evolution on us. And we're about to take it in a direction that obviously will lead to our own destruction and to our own enslavement, which in a way is worse than destruction. So we have to first sensitize people to this reality, pray for a de-technologization of the world. That is, if there are events that can bring back some form of religious conservatism. I was, for example, studying the hypothesis of a complete domination of planet Earth by Islam, Muslims, and social conservatism coming with it. Perhaps in that world, there wouldn't be enough genetic research to bring us to the precipice of phenotypic revolutions. So we have to think out of the box. We have also to think over many generations. It's very unusual for political thinkers to think over what's happening in 1,000 years, what's happening in 10,000 years. Yeah. It's not necessarily the case that the whole progressivism that has marked the era for the last 400 years will be forever going. There is a limit to everything, and progressivism and techno-enthusiasm will have its own limit. And I hope that this limit will come to disable even our ability to create the phenotypic revolution.
Wow. Yeah, it really is death by self-knowledge. Yeah, you get to, yes. That is crazy. That's mind-blowing. You just learn so much about you, yourself, your race, your species that you, and it's also, like you said, it comes from an air of self-improvement. You don't want people to get certain sicknesses. You don't like that, people of low IQ. You don't like Down syndrome, whatever the case may be, and you want to fix these things. But that is the trap that ensnares us. Do I have that right?
Oh yeah, absolutely. And it's fascinating to think that the path to the phenotypic revolution is covered with goodness. There's literally not a step up to your own destruction that is undesirable. Everything is tempting, because if you want to combat the phenotypic revolution, you're going to have to accept to say to a child that has whatever ailment, ABC, yeah. you're going to have to keep suffering from yep. it because we don't want to destroy ourselves. You're going to have to, as I was making a joke on another show years ago, you're going to have to distribute pamphlets that say, see this child with Parkinson's disease? You're going to have to endure it because we're not healing him, even if we could.
Yeah.
Wow. It's a hard sell.
Yeah. Because what parent wouldn't want to do something to make their kids suffer less?
Yes.
Yeah.
It's a hard sell, but it is the only path through which we still exist in a million years from now.
Wow.
So you do what you want, but... of all the civilization that are faced with this decision, I'm sure that most of them continue towards self-destruction because you've been so trained. Everything you've always discovered was always good for you. You know, there's almost not a thing that you can think of that you wouldn't want to know. Knowledge is either neutral or it helps you, right? But that's true until you have knowledge of your own genes to the point where you want to replace them. That is the barrier that we should not pass.
Gotcha. So yeah, so I'm gonna ask something, and it's a big conversation or whatever. I just want to kind of poke pick at your brain about it. But so this is a theory of yours, and what I'm basically wondering is what would it take, and more broadly, just evolution in general. What would it take for these things to get brought into? To have some doubt about them in your brain, like I guess it's what's falsifiability, making it falsifiable. What would it take for you to reject evolution and especially your theory of phenotypic revolution?
Well, any sort of demonstration that the world of living things that we know of through observation doesn't fit that model.
Okay.
Because theories are always a model. The theory of evolution is a model. The theory of phenotypic revolution is also a model. Mm-hmm. The question is this model properly arrimated to reality? Is there a correspondence between my ideas and reality? I am absolutely certain as a competent scientist that I got it, that it is totally fitting reality. But that is something you should bring to me if you want to convince me of the contrary of the theory of evolution, that the theory of evolution is false. You would have to show me an observation that doesn't fit with it or that is contradictory to it. So when you look, for example, at the ribosome of bacteria and you compare it to humans, there is a familial link here. So somehow the mechanism that led to bacteria being able to produce proteins must be tied historically to what led to humans being that way also, because it's the same gene. It's a gene that resembles itself, that has still conserved some similarity. Evolution explains this extremely well. I don't know that a God hypothesis where God just seeds the earth with the separate life forms, I don't know that it explains it correctly.
Gotcha. All right. So you mentioned IQ briefly, and I know there are a couple topics that we can't kind of go near. So you just let me know if I'm like encroaching close to the line. But do you view IQ as mostly genetic?
Yes.
Okay.
I believe that if you want to know whether a behavior or a measure is genetic in humans, the best standard for this is twin studies, and the twin studies results are categorical and they have been repeated again and again. It's one of the things we're most sure of in behavioral psychiatry, that IQ is largely determined by genes with what I call a floor of 80%. So I'm pretty sure that 80% of the variance that you see around you, that is everything that you observe from a very low IQ person to a very high IQ person, 80% of that difference is explainable by genetics. And I personally think much more.
Okay.
Because I think that twin studies can only really reach a floor of estimation rather than a ceiling.
And so the IQ stands for intelligence quotient. But how would you explain to a person that's never heard of it before what IQ is?
Well, IQ is our attempt as humans to measure what we feel exists, which is intelligence. Everyone has the impression, you know, when you've spoken to people of various intelligence, you know that there are some of them who maybe couldn't even drive a car ever in their life. You know, people who are very, very low IQ. And you know that some of them could explain to you the basics of elementary arithmetics on a board, and even if they're not teachers, even if they haven't done it before. That kind of potential for intelligence statement and predictability of the world and explainability of the world, that is what we tend to think of as IQ, as intelligence. And IQ is an attempt to measure this by trying to find the test that isolate this property from other properties of the brain, like its ability to learn arbitrary language, its ability to be plastic, its ability to develop motor reactions like in sports. IQ is this thing that is separate from this, and that it's an attempt to measure intelligence.
Okay, and so are you saying that IQ is it's a separate thing from verbal intelligence?
Certainly. Okay. I mean, you can use a test of verbal intelligence to derive an IQ. In fact, you can use any test you want to derive an IQ, mm-hmm. because an IQ is just a mathematical construct. But I do claim that the thing that we try to measure best with the IQ test is the G factor, which is this cognitive capacity measure. And I do claim that it's independent of verbal capacities,
okay.
and language learning.
And what type of, have you taken an IQ test before?
Just once, okay. live on a show back in my Andy Warski days.
Okay.
And I had 129 on the test, but it was an internet test and I was live. So perhaps I underperformed a little bit.
Yeah, yeah, I have trouble believing that your IQ isn't higher than that. I've been talking about this lately that I'm actually scared to take one. Because I've been saying that I'm afraid of whatever it would be. Like, say it's extremely high, I'm just a piece of shit that's underachieving. If it's extremely, I would probably prefer that it be low. Cause then I'm overachieving, but I'm scared of whatever it would be. There's not one number you could tell me that I wouldn't be terrified of. Do you think you'll ever take one? What do you like pay for it and go into a place like a professional one? Do you have any plans to do that?
I won't, because I don't care. Yeah. I don't even value intelligence that much. Mm. I ended up being one of the speaking faces of the intelligence field and its relation to race at times. Just because I like truth.
Yeah.
And I can't help it when people super chat me, I say the truth. And so I said the truth about all these subjects, and somehow I became the only person in like with a PhD and with a standing in academia capable of defending the harshest truth. It's really first and foremost my interest with truth and whether we can speak it.
Right.
That brought me in that direction. I don't really care about IQ that much.
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting. And that's something that we have in common, where I just love the truth and I like talking about whatever's interesting, whatever I'm curious about, I like talking about it. And it's got me in a ton. I mean, almost every old friend I ever had has disowned me. A bunch of family members, you know, they don't talk to me as much. Not that I don't really blame them that much, because this type of stuff is hot fire to the mainstream normie in real life world. You can't just go around talking about this stuff in polite society. So here we are on the internet, but you just committed to the truth from day one and you are where you are, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
And you're going to lose a lot of people, but I think it's fine. It's it's my auditing process. When I talk to you about my fascination with the media and what it changed, there's the auditing. People are self-filtering outside of this conversation because they know they can't handle it. Mm. And I want to know, is there anyone out there who likes the truth enough that they're willing to undergo the massive cost of social punishment? Mm. I'm one of them. Maybe you're one of them. I'd like to know if there are more.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that maybe not the more the better, but there needs to be more people like that. There needs to be more people. I think the world would maybe like explode or something, like spontaneously combust, if every person was like that, because we're kind of the exception or whatever, but more people need to love the truth. I think that's very important. I don't know how we get that to be in the real world, because it just seems like you leave the internet and like when you interact with a person in the real world that just loves the truth, it's a breath of fresh air. It feels like the internet. Do you think that would be a good thing for the world, to get your average person this into talking about the truth?
Well, I think that a lot of people out there are simply not intelligent enough, and they couldn't handle the truth, you know, as they say in the movie.
Yeah.
So I'm not for shocking people with truths they don't want to hear, but I want people to realize it's not merely just a hobby, a truth-seeking hobby. There's a war going on, and this is the subject of my second book, which I've not finished yet, The Moral Signal. There's a war for the moral signal. There's a war for everything that will ever be said. If you think of all the words that were ever uttered, they're all attempts at controlling someone else and directing them in a slightly different direction. And when you obfuscate certain subjects, when you say, all right, this is outside the bounds of what we can speak, I'm afraid that there are political interests behind this, that there are ethnic interests at times. That there is an ethnic war going on, and a lie is the first action of a genocide, I'm afraid. And when you lie about statistics that could help people protect themselves against crime, you are opening the door to an ongoing genocide, which I think we're going through right now. I can't help but think of all those ignorant, naive liberals who have been cradled into deception all their lives and who think, it doesn't matter which neighborhood I go live in. We live in a society that is open and free, and diversity is good. But some of them end up dead. They end up dead because they made the wrong choice. And that's why deception always ends up in an evolutionary differential. It ends up in some people surviving, some people not surviving.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah, it's very sad when that happens. Also, but it also, I don't want to say it's totally funny, but it's just that they believe the lie for so long, and they put their lives on the line. They literally will bet their life on it, and it backfires on them, and you're just like, dang. But what isn't funny about it is not enough people change. They never. You know, the people that are alive and liberal never end up saying, oh, I wonder if there's some truth to these people that we call Nazis all the time, and not enough of them change. I mean, so just to be clear, you're speaking about a white genocide?
Yes, yeah. I believe that white people are being killed at rates that they haven't historically faced, that is not justified. And that is inspired by hate, inspired by a centralized communication of hate, by controlling authorities, the media, and groups that just hate white people for some reason.
Yeah. What do you think that reason is?
Well, it probably stems from, I believe that there is an intense dislike of whites at the root emotional level that probably stems from the people who hate white people today are probably, they are ethnophilic. They somehow made a living from this ecological niche of dissociating from Europe and reproducing with people from outside, gaining from this whole increase of diversity, sometimes for themselves, sometimes through genetic mixing, and sometimes through things like affirmative action. Mm. Basically, there are way too many winners from this anti-white hate. There are economic winners, there are genetic winners, there are people who don't care. And I think that the world always kind of leads toward this melting pot of uniformization, and that to distinguish really a white race for it to continue existing, it must be isolated in the way it was historically, which is it must be hard to travel to Europe and survive in Europe. I think that one of the evolutionary errors of white people would have been to heat up the world, to create so much technology that life became comfortable even for non-whites in Northern Europe.
Wow. I've never heard that take before. That's very interesting. Wow. It's like, that's the real global warming, right?
Yes.
Wow. Where do you think, and again, you can just stop me if we get too close to something that's weird for you, but where do you think race came from? Like, where did that, like, where was the first, you know, white guy? Where's the first black? Where did that come from in your, yeah, what region of the world?
Well,
we
know exactly how it happens, because we even have experiments where we see speciation happening in species of fish, for example. So if you want to know about it, you have to read the book by Why Evolution is True. I forget his name, but that's the name of his blog, Why Evolution is True. He wrote a book called Speciation. Mm. And speciation happens because you can't fuck everyone equally. You can't inject your sperm in all females of planet Earth. You have to have a subset. And because you have a subset and the guy beside you has a subset, it ends up being, there's a genetic direction that emerges from the fact that you don't have sex with everyone at all times in equal amounts. Mm. And that, just out of randomness, will lead to subsets of genes being more represented in certain areas and than others. Mm-hmm. Now, that's just randomness and that's just drift. It happens naturally and it will happen if you let it happen in any population. On top of it, there's natural selection, which is that the white skin is probably an adaptation specifically to the European schedule of sun that we get. We probably needed, since we have less sun coming to us, less sun rays, we probably needed to get the most of them to hit us for the purpose of vitamin D production, or maybe some people say for the purpose of mutation of our genes so that we mutate and continue evolving. For some reason, obfuscating the sun rays onto our skin was a problem. And we evolved to be white to get the most of them. Because that's what the pigment that leads people to be black is melanin. And melanin is a sun blocker, basically. It's like the sunblock solutions. It absorbs the ray of light and it doesn't let it pass. So you need a darker skin if you live around the equator. You need a paler skin if you live in Europe. Mm.
Do you think that race is just skin color?
No, certainly not, because I think then if you're referring to the differences in intelligence across race, for example, I think that different societies will reward intelligence differently.
Yeah.
There are some societies where you could be a genius and it won't change anything. You're going to end up being beaten like the next person. And it's all going to boil down to, are you stronger than the other? And can you keep him from beating you? Now, in a society that is overly violent, overly criminal, that doesn't respect rights of property, or that doesn't have much resources to develop stable property, there may be no reason why you need intelligence. And intelligence, in fact, might be very much punished. There are some culture on Earth where we see people denigrating young, intelligent people, giving them trouble for being geeks, basically. You know, the classical case of the school bully. Mm. So there are other societies where property is stable. Crimes are not to be expected in super high rates. So if you accumulate some property, you can hope that it won't be stolen from you the next day. And there are challenges coming from the seasons, like the winter. Perhaps people have laid out the theory of the cold winter theory of European intelligence, which would be that if there's a winter coming, you have to plan your sources of food 6 months in advance. And that leads to a lot of things being rewarded in terms of capacity to plan, capacity to expect, capacity to prepare, self-control, self-limitations on consumption. All of them eventually could have built the European mind as it stands now.
Mm, wow, fascinating. And, you know, this is, I've never asked a biologist or a person that knows about genetics this before, but there's that thing, the warrior gene. Does that exist? I mean, what is that? Does that exist? Tell us about that if you can.
I mean, yeah, it's a gene that we've detected that is associated with more violence. And you, if you have that gene, you just have more chance to become a criminal later in life. The wire gene may be a little bit of an exaggeration and a misnomer, but that's what it is. That's what we do. And it's not even the only gene. There's a series of genes that we can associate with various outcomes, thousands of them. If you include everything we know about IQ, crime, all sorts of important psychiatric disorders, we have thousands of different letters of DNA that we know are associated with one outcome or the other.
Yeah. Okay. Do you believe in some sort of free will? Do you believe in free will? Do you believe in determinism, or like where do you see as because I was going to ask you too about what do you think emotions really are? Is there a biological basis for that? But do you believe in free will?
I don't believe in free will.
Okay.
I see ourselves. Yes, we have the capacity to make decisions, but this making of the decision is happening through a mechanistic process in our brain. I don't believe that there is any other dimension of existence that where souls are contained or whatever. So I believe that we are machines. We are machines, but machines can make decisions. Machine, like a car, can veer left or it can veer right, but it's all according to a very predetermined mechanism around the wheel drive. And we have wheel drives in our head that are guiding us right or left, depending on the choice. If you want to call this free will, that's a little bit the direction that Daniel Dennett is taking in Philosophy of Mind. You could call it, well, they call it compatibilism. This whole idea that, oh, well, we can redefine free will to mean this capacity of the machine to be swayed left or right. But then a car has free will, and then a piece of Lego has free will.
So you don't believe in any type of, I mean, what do you think? You don't think we have a soul?
We have a very complex virtual construct that exists in the machines that our brains implement.
Okay.
I have the highest respect for this virtual construct, but it is just a virtual construct. It doesn't rise when you die, and it doesn't keep existing when you destroy the brain.
All right. Wow. Very interesting stuff. So what's the name of your next book again? And when does it have a due date or anything? You've been very, very generous with your time, so I'll let you go soon. But what's the name of your next book? When's
the
it coming
name of
out?
My yeah. next book is The Moral Signal. I've been saying that it was being completed within 3 months, but I've been saying this for 5 years.
Okay. All right. So it's been 5 years of a couple months. Yeah. All right.
Yes.
Yeah. What's your writing process look like? I mean, you know, one of our last questions, what does your day look like? Cause I've seen you mentioned on some of your content that you stay up very late, that you sleep, you're kind of a night owl. What is a day look like for you? A normal day?
Well, these days, a day involves a police interrogation about my disappeared wife.
Holy crap.
Just to reassure them that I'm not a murderer. Yeah. So
Is that every day?
That was actually
Are you serious?
What happened. Today again. Today, they called me and I went to the station and they wanted further details from me. This has been taking a lot of my time in the last 2 weeks. But other than this, I'm really a fundamental guy, fascinated by... First, my day is built around being productive in some of my contractual work, which is mathematics work. So I do cryptography and mathematical cryptography for security on the internet. And so in a way, I really love where my life has converged, where I'm at home at all time. I don't have to drive to a job. I think about mathematical problems and networks, which is exactly what has fascinated me since I'm a child. I get to spend time with family and loved ones while thinking about the world. And so then on the side to my contractual work, I also try to prepare one show per day. So I stream 7 days a week at 7 p.m. Eastern time. So there's lots of just reading the news, refreshing the social media, seeing what's hot right now, what's the hottest thing today to talk about. And then I go to sleep typically thinking about mathematical problems and networks and how to improve them and how to secure them.
Wow. And there's some writing in there, you know. You probably need to write a little bit more, right, to get that
I've actually not touched the moral signal for maybe a year, so wow. I do have to get back to it. I mean, writing isn't happening so much as writing. To me, writing often happened when I was driving for like 15 hours. When I was driving from Quebec to North Carolina, I would think about the ideas in the revolutionary phenotype. And that's so much more important than the writing of the words. The writing of the words, it's easy to do, and you can even get an employee to do it. Like, you can write a draft and it will embellish it. But the fundamental ideas is what matters, and that you cannot push. So that is work that has to come at the speed that it comes.
Gotcha. Well, you're a fascinating guy, man. This is very cool. Why don't you tell the people, this is going to be a podcast too, so tell the people how to find your work online. I'll put everything below in the show description, but why don't you tell us how to find you?
You can go to jfg.world and you'll see the links to all my social media, jfg.world.
JFG.world. All right. Well, I'll see you out there on the internet. Good luck with your book. And I hope that the police troubles go away soon. That's I hate hearing that because I've had some interactions with the cops myself, and it's never fun. So I wish you all the best. All right.
All right. Bye-bye.
All right. See you. Bye-bye. JF Garriott. That was cool. Good talk. Interesting guy. High IQ. Got to give that some ruminate. There's a ton of stuff we disagree on. I'm doing an interview, so I don't really care all that much about even getting into that. Obviously, I mean, I don't believe in evolution. I believe in God. We differ on very important things, but always like picking a guy's brain. Always like getting his side of the story. I could not muster up the cojones to ask him to speak American. Maybe that'll be the next one. But this has been an episode of Call Me Ignorant. Thank you so much for watching the video. Really appreciate it. I hope you enjoyed it. If you go over to the channel, hit subscribe. That'd be awesome. Ignoramus videos over there on YouTube. Also, please go over to my link tree. That is linktr.ee/ignoramusmedia and give me a follow on all the different platforms listed over there. We live stream on Ignoramus Streams YouTube as well as Rumble and Odyssey every weekday, 9 a.m. Eastern Time. The first hour is a Bible study, and then at 10 a.m., we start the Daily Ignoramus, which is, you know, politics, news, current events, things like that. Also just having a general good time. So yeah, go over to the link tree listed below in the show description. Follow all the channels, please. Also, there's links there to donate and to do a monthly subscription over at Subscribestar. So yeah, 9 a.m. every single weekday. Check out the content, and I'll see you guys next time.